Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. In this episode, Korean Context spoke to comedian and actor Steve Byrne of the brand new TBS series Sullivan & Sons. Known as one of the hardest working and energetic comics in the US, since his first show in 1997, Byrne has gradually risen to the top and become one of America's premier comics to watch. Hailing from Pittsburgh, Byrne was born to a Korean mother and an Irish father, and has been featured in numerous comedy tours and festivals, including the Kims of Comedy, with fellow Korean-American comedians Bobby Lee, Ken Jeong, and Kevin Shea. In this podcast, I talked to Byrne over Skype about his links to Korea, his decision to pursue a career in comedy, and his new project, Sullivan & Sons. I started the conversation by asking Byrne about what it was like growing up in Pittsburgh in the 1970s as a child of Korean and Irish descent.
I had the same kind of upbringing as anybody else here. It's just, you know, the only thing different was that my mom had a thicker accent and I was checking her homework instead of her checking mine, because she was always trying to learn and become better at English. But yeah, other than that, I mean, you know, when you're younger, you get teased a lot for being different. You know, if you're super tall, if you're awkward, you got a lot of zit on your face, or, you know, you got big ears. Mine just happened to be that I was Korean and Irish, so a lot of kids would pick on me because of that. But that's where I developed my sense of humor as like a thing to combat it. And I thought if I could just, you know, always be a little funnier than the people making fun of me, maybe I could win them over. So that was kind of where my sense of humor, I think, developed. Because when I moved from New Jersey to Pittsburgh, it was the kind of at that age where you're starting to make friends and, you know, trying to fit in. And that's where that all came about.
And so I guess aside from like providing ample material for your comedy, how has your sort of Korean Irish heritage affected your life, your career? You know, did your mom want you to be an investment banker, as many Korean moms do? Or
she just wanted me, you know, because she came over here, she was dirt poor, literally, I mean, dirt poor. And, you know, she just always believed in the American dream. And so anything that I was trying to achieve, she always just made sure, and my father too, they always instilled that I always do my best no matter what. You know, it's okay to fail, you know, as long as you failed really, really trying to do whatever it is you were trying to accomplish. So they were both pretty, I wouldn't say hard on me, but pretty animate about me doing the best I can in any facet that I do, no matter how crappy of a job I had as a teenager. Or, you know, I played hockey a lot, so every time I played a game, it was always make sure you do your best. And, you know, I think that bled into a lot of the drive that I had in my later years as a stand-up.
Did it bleed into creating a drive to learn Korean at all?
not really. When I was younger, this is horrible, but, you know, I was a kid. I was maybe 4 or 5 or whatever, and my mom kept trying to teach me Korean, and I said, I don't want to learn Chinese. So that was pretty dumb of me. But, you know, when I got into college, that's when I really accepted my background, accepted who I was, appreciated my mom, appreciated her story, and appreciated my parents' story. And I did study Korean for 2 years at Kent State. But it's, again, language is something you got to keep up on, or it's just going to it's just going to fade. It's like a relationship. So I just kind of dropped off on that.
And what about Irish?
I've been to Dublin twice, but it wasn't necessarily to get in touch with my roots. I was there for St. Patrick's Day, and I was doing shows at the Jameson distillery. I used to do this Jameson whiskey comedy tour with Billy Gardell from the show Mike and Molly. We toured together for a long time along with some other great comics on that. So I've been to Ireland a few times. I've been to China, Japan. I've been everywhere but Korea. So I'm looking forward to getting to Korea at some point. Hopefully this show does well enough that I can fly my whole family out there with me and experience it.
Nice. Well, slancha, that's the extent of my Irish language skills.
Yeah.
yes, I guess, you know, we've spoke to quite a few Korean American actors, cultural figures in recent years, and you're the first comedian I guess we've spoke to. What do you think of the rise of like other Korean American comedians like Margaret Cho, John Cho, Ken Jeong? Do you feel like there's any kind of commonality behind all your popularity, or is that just coincidence?
I don't know that there's a commonality other than the fact that we all, I'm sure, appreciate each other's work and appreciate the struggle that we go through to gain any notoriety, I think, in the entertainment business. You know, Ken and I have been great friends for a long time. We kind of, you know, when I first moved to Los Angeles, he was one of the first guys, along with Bobby Lee, that I met. And they used to take me out to all the clubs and, you know, get me past at the Improv, get me past the Comedy Store. And then fortunately for us, we all got to tour together for a while as the Kims of Comedy. And that was a blast. So to get to see Ken attain the success that he's attained, he's become almost like the Samuel Jackson of Asians. I've never seen anybody work as much or be in such huge blockbuster films as he has. So, you know, I really tip my cap to him because I know how hard he's worked. And I think, you know, with stand-up comedy, it always goes back to Richard Pryor. But I think in terms of any Asian stand-up comic out there, you go to Margaret Cho or Henry Cho, and you know they kind of paved the way for us, and they were the first. So I really tip my cap to them as well.
Right, and do you think people know or care that all of you guys are of Korean descent, or do you think in general Americans tend to just sort of lump you in with all other Asian comics?
I think Americans tend to just lump us all together, but fortunately, you know, for some reason or another, they've all been Korean, the ones that have really made it in terms of becoming a household name. I mean, I remember seeing Henry Cho on Caroline's Comedy Hour, and then Margaret, obviously, with All American Girl, you know, her having the first kind of sitcom, which was, I remember as being a really cool thing, and I thought, wow, that's pretty awesome. It's kind of possible. So I think, though, generally speaking, if you ask the common American, you know, in somewhere in the Midwest, that they would just all assume that we're just Asian. I don't know that they could decipher the difference, but they'd be right if they guessed Korean, because most of us are.
And I mean, you're probably aware of, the Korean wave, or Hallyu as it's called. And that's been spreading from Korea. You've got your K-pop stars coming through and everything. Do you think that the sort of rising popularity of these Korean comedians or comedians from Korean descent is something related to that, or it's just a facet of the kind of American melting pot effect we have here?
I think it's a facet of the melting pot, and I think that, you know, my struggle has always been, you know, even though I'm Korean and Irish, I'm half, I'm not full Korean, so I never wanted that to be a focal point of my stand-up either. I never wanted to be exclusive to one group. I wanted to be inclusive of everybody, and that was why the basis of my second hour special was about being an American. I think if we all, you know, once you're here, you get your citizenship, or if you're born here, it's always great to appreciate your roots, but I think if we all just looked at each other as Americans, life would be a lot easier. And I think if we were able to joke with each other and not so PC and acknowledge the differences that different cultures have that make our country great as Americans, I think we'd learn to get along a lot better and have a lot more fun doing it.
Were there any like particularly salient episodes of cultural misunderstanding that I guess gave you inspiration for some of your material?
Yeah, that second hour special that I did, the Burn Identity. I mean, for me, it was just very significant because it's where I kind of learned my voice. I developed my voice, and it all stemmed from I went to Beijing in 2008 for the Olympics with my friend Vince Vaughn. He was kind enough to bring me along, and I went over there with him, and everybody kept asking, "What are you? What are you? What are you?" I was like, "Oh, American." You know, it's such an international event. And I kept telling everybody I was American, but then you come back to America and people was like, "Well, what are you?" It's like, "Oh, I'm Korean and Irish." And I just thought how much easier life would be if I just looked at myself as an American, even when I'm in America. And that's kind of that was a springboard for me in terms of being inspired to write new material for an hour-long special.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I mean, for me personally, coming here, I really do notice when I meet people, they love to tell you about, their relationship to Ireland. So many people talk about an Irish great grandfather or something. But then when you meet them outside of the country, like you say, it's America first and foremost. Like, what do you think? There's something particular about American culture that is lending towards that kind of differentiation?
I don't know the answer to that. I just don't, because I think that, for example, if you watch the Jersey Shore, they're so proud to be Italian, so proud to be Italian. And then they go to Italy and the don't even like them. In Italy, towards the end of the season, they're just like, I can't wait to get back to America. So I think that's a great reflection of how people can really view themselves, particularly, as Americans, because I think it's so great to think, the grass is always greener on the other side, but, the people that hate America, the people that bash America, the people that say the government is this, the people, the country is this, I'm so and so, this is my real background. It's like, well, let me see your passport. Let's see if you actually been over there. Let's see if you really have developed a true opinion, because until you've left this country and see how it is in other places, I think you'll have a greater appreciation for this country and how great it is and how new it is and how communal it is. I was in New York during 9/11, and see the way that the city galvanized. Differences went out the door, and it was the greatest year, I think, in terms of being an American, that I personally had. Just being in that city and seeing how everybody embraced each other and how people would open doors for each other. Just, it didn't matter where you were from. You were on that island. You were in New York City. You're an American. So that was great.
And just to sort of, change topic a little bit. What was it that sort of drove you or motivated you, I guess, early on to pursue this career in comedy?
I never wanted to be a stand-up. I never intended to be a stand-up. I'd never been to a stand-up comedy club until I started working at one, and that's why I got into it, because I moved to New York City after I finished college, and I walked up and down New York City into different restaurants to just be a waiter in any restaurant, or a cook, just do anything to just make money and get by fresh out of college. And the last place I walked into was a comedy club on Broadway, and they hired me right on the spot. And the next day, I was answering phones and sweeping the floor, and from there on out, I spent another 4 months just watching stand-up and being seduced by it. I just thought, wow, that looks like a lot of fun. I'd like to try that out someday. And then another month or two went by, and I went up for the first time at a club called Stand Up New York on the west side of New York City. And as soon as I got off stage, I literally just walked off stage and I said, I'm doing that the rest of my life. I don't
So
but I'm gonna do that.
you must have been pretty good then first time, because I'm sure a lot of budding comedians probably walk off thinking, hell, I can't ever do that again.
Yeah, fortunately for me, the first time went really well. The second, third time was horrible. So my next few times was just chasing, get back to that first time and see if I could do it again. And maybe I've been doing it ever since. I don't know, but it's a complete blast. I've been very blessed. I think some people spend their lives trying to find their calling in life, and I think sometimes your calling finds you, and that was the case for me. I've just been very blessed to have an occupation that I get to pursue and get to make a living from, and it's something I'm passionate about and I love. I'm not going to work every day doing something I hate.
Right. And your family, they were like supportive of you early on.
Yeah, my folks have been very supportive every step of the way. In New York City, when you're performing at open mics, the first 3 months, my parents did this for me every weekend. Once a week, I would perform. And in order for you to perform at a club, you'd have to bring two paying customers that would pay a cover charge and buy two drinks. And if two customers, that allotted you 5 minutes on stage. And the first 3 months I did stand up, literally every Saturday night, my parents would come and be my two patrons. So I owe a lot to them.
Oh, good stuff. And did you have any inspirations growing up, or were you, this is just your own thing, kind of?
Yeah, I don't think I had any inspirations. I wasn't a kid. When I was growing up, I remember everybody had those Andrew Dice Clay tapes that they'd put in the Walkman or listen to Eddie Murphy. And I was into hockey. I loved playing ice hockey. I could care less about stand-up comedy. I could care less about comedy in general. And then, again, once I got into that stand-up comedy club when I was working there, that's when it just clicked for me. So I was always inspired by the comics that I saw in New York City night after night after night, like Greg Giraldo, Patrice O'Neill, these two gentlemen unfortunately passed away within the last year or two, but they were great stand-up comics. Colin Quinn, Jim Norton, Robert Kelly, Keith Robinson. These were all guys that I met at the Comedy Cellar that really inspired me to become as good as I could be as a comic.
And just out of interest, you touched on Eddie Murphy there. I mean, I watched stuff like Delirious, and it blows your mind to see how much comedy has changed, because some of the things he was saying back then, it would be pretty tough to get away with now. In the time you've been kind of working on comedy, have you noticed any shift in the last 10 years in
Literally the last week, Kenny Loggins getting in trouble, with Dane Cook getting in trouble. Nowadays, comedy clubs are kind of the one place where it should be the Wild West. It's literally the epitome of freedom of speech, where you can go into a forum and people pay to go into that forum and expect that they're going to hear whatever comes out of that comedian's mouth, good or bad. And for the most part, it's usually good, because they went there to go see a particular performer, so they know what to expect. But I think nowadays, with everybody being able to film anything on a phone, even secretly, now it can be uploaded and anybody in the world can see a comic even trying out material before he gets to put it on television or have it be part of an hour special. And I think sometimes when you're trying out new material as a comic, you'll just literally say whatever comes to your mind and trust your instincts. And you do walk the line. And sometimes as a comic, you do cross that line. But you don't know unless you have the liberty to test those boundaries out nightly in those comedy clubs, where you should have free rein. And I think when, the media takes the side of a blogger in terms of Daniel Tosh's case, instead of a guy who's been doing stand-up for 15 or 20 years, and just say, you know what, he's in a comedy club. That's where that stuff's supposed to happen. So I'll always have the side of any comedian. Again, I always go back to, us always. My stand-up has always been coming from a place of good natured, of appreciating everybody for their differences, and still being able to make fun of each other, but not in a hateful way, but in an inclusive way. I have jokes that are about Asians, that are about gays, that are about blacks. But at the end of the day, I always try to bring everybody together. I think the greatest scene in a movie that I've seen recently is Gran Torino, where Clint Eastwood brings the young boy into the barber shop, and he teaches the young boy how grown men talk. And I always thought that was a huge inspiration in terms of creating one of the characters that we have on Sullivan's Son, where it's just like, I think if you mask yourself as being harmonious with everybody, that's usually those are usually the people that are first to say something hateful, as opposed to the people that say these trigger words with their friends, but it's not hateful at all. They're accepting of their friends.
But when does it go too far? Because I mean, if you look at, for example, in Britain, where I'm from, some of the comedians from the early 80s and late 70s, I think it's safe to say, were genuinely racist, and a lot of the jokes were pejorative. And when in your mind do you think it can go too far?
Look, the audience is the greatest barometer in stand-up comedy. They'll know when you're lying. They'll know when it's not funny. They'll tell you when a joke's not funny. It just is or isn't. And when you're on stage, it's the most transparent, I think, of art forms, in terms of the audience instantly letting you know whether it's good or bad, whether it's truly hateful or it's coming from a jovial place. And I think that when something is said truly out of hate, people will pick up on it. And that person, at the end of the day, probably isn't going to be working too long in this industry, because there are those Hawkeyes that have magnifying glasses that will truly call somebody out for saying something truly hateful. Unfortunately, I think, like Michael Richards, for example, when you drop that N-bomb, that's kind of the holy grail in terms of horrible things to say in this country. And I wasn't there. I can't personally speak if it was truly hateful or not. But when you hear that word, instantly, that word in this country has so many associations of hate that it's just not tolerated at all. It's a word that I personally don't like. I personally would never use it. But again, I wasn't there, and I can't speak on behalf of anybody else that was in the audience, or him, as a human being or as a comic.
Do you think, moving on a little bit, do you think comedians can be good politicians? We have some experience with this here in Washington, D.C., with Senator Al Franken, for example.
Well, I think Al Franken, fortunately for him, he grew up without YouTube or Twitter, because I think any comedian that would ever want to run for office right now, when you run somebody, that person will literally sift through every aspect of your life trying to find something dirty. And I guarantee these days with Twitter, with YouTube, with Facebook, there's going to be something you said in a comedy club or tweeted or posted on Facebook at some point that somebody could blow up and take the wrong way, and it could just derail any chances of you ever being taken seriously as a candidate for office in this country.
So, I mean, I'm getting the sense that you have some issues in some ways with this new social media phenomenon, the fact that people can record things. I guess it helps you in some ways because it really can get you out there, but there is a big cost associated with it in terms of your freedom as an artist. If you're weighing it up, do you think there's a net benefit, or it's really you're getting into difficult territory for stand-up comedians?
Any of those social media platforms, they're always used for the most part as com for comedians to let people know where they're performing. If you're touring, you want to let people know what city or club you'll be in, and that's usually how it's used. But you do have to post things online. You do have to keep relevant and say things that are humorous. You don't want to just keep saying, "Hey, I'm at the Chattanooga this weekend," or whatever, and then I'm in Pittsburgh this weekend. That's only going to go so far. But I do think that it is dangerous in terms of people using it, to their advantage. If they don't like you, they're going to find something horrible about you. And if they gain enough traction, they could really make you look horrible or put you in an ill light. And that's the danger in it. And individuals can do that to themselves as well. So I think you have to walk the line and always be aware. And it's something that I'm trying to be more aware of now. Being on a television show, when I was just a stand-up, I was only held accountable to me and my standards. And if I said something horrible, well, guess what? Maybe I'm not working in that city again. But now that I'm on a television show, so now I have some bosses, and I've got to be aware of everything that I post now, and keep that in mind.
Now, funnily enough, I actually heard about your show a few weeks ago while I was in a taxi cab in New York City. So, your promotion is there. But yeah, what was it that made you move from New York to LA? Was that actually part of the deal with setting up your show?
No, I moved to Los Angeles 7 or 8 years ago to give myself the best opportunity to become a national headliner. I have a lot of friends that are still in New York City that are, I feel that there is a complacency, a comfortableness where you can make a living paying rent, being a professional stand-up comic in New York City. You can do 7 or 8 shows a night. You can make a decent chunk of change. You can do late night talk shows and be known as a comic. But my goal wasn't to just be a big comic in New York City. I wanted the country, everybody. And the only way to do that is to start, I believe, with a good set of tools that I acquired after putting the time in New York City and going to Los Angeles and trying to gain some notoriety there. So I went to Los Angeles, got an hour special, and then I hit the road becoming a national comic. I did 50 weeks a year living out of a suitcase for the last 7 or 8 years of my life. And then, being friends with Vince Vaughn, he's kind of some of his shows, the Wild West touring shows, and he said, "You should create a vehicle for yourself." And I did. I had never written anything before. I never tried that aspect. I never knew what to do, but he was very encouraging. I went out and bought some books. I wrote a pilot on my own. I turned it into him. He paired me up with some writers, and now I have a show on the air. So, I mean, I make it sound a lot easier, but 14 years in the making, it's a lot of dirt underneath my. And anybody that knows me knows that I've always worked hard. I've always put everything I have into this business, into this occupation, and it was definitely earned. Nothing was ever given to me. So I feel that I've definitely earned this opportunity, and I'm trying to make the most of it. And that's why I'm even talking right now, trying to do everything I can in outlet to let people know about the show.
So tell us about your show, Sullivan and Sons. What's the basic premise of it?
The foundation of it, and then the show will spiral off from there. Who knows where it'll be 2 years, 3 years from now, knock on wood if we get that opportunity. But the foundation is, when I was writing it, people always told me, write about what you know. And at the time, again, I'd given everything to my professional life. I didn't really have much to say for my personal life. I thought, well, why not create a show where a guy gets to move back home, wherever that home is, and he gets to be with his friends and family. And that was kind of the foundation of the show, having a meaningful life, and not just giving your all to professional life. So, Long and I got together and restructured the foundation of my pilot and made it a corporate attorney who was in New York City chasing the rat race. And he gets to come back home to Pittsburgh for his father's 65th birthday and realizes that his parents are going to sell the barn, retire. And over the course of the weekend, he learns how meaningful his father's life is and being this unofficial town mayor to the city or to that neighborhood and being with his friends and family. He decides that's what I want in life. I want to continue the tradition that my grandfather and father have started and be a bartender here in Pittsburgh.
And were these supporting characters creative choices, or is this very autobiographical caricatures of your own family?
Well, it's a huge, diverse, multi-generational, multi-ethnic cast, and we have a large cast. We got nine cast members, but I wanted it to be reflective of a world that I want to be in, where, for example, Hank is like that Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. Having my parents be a part of it, I think seeing a mixed ethnic kind of background with Korean and Irish parents, I thought that could be a fun angle. And then I wanted to throw some girls in there too, because I think it's important to have their perspective and see what directions their characters can go with Valerie Gaslin and Vivian Bang. And then I wrote three of my friends in the show, never anticipating that we'd cast all three of them. But Ahmed Ahmed, Owen Benjamin, Roy Wood Jr. These are three comedians that I love their work. I'm actually friends with them, and I wrote them in as templates. I never thought three for three in casting them. But that's a testament to how great of a partner TBS is in them believing in us and saying, if this is what you believe in, then let's go with it. And I'm very fortunate to have had that, because every day I've gone to work, I get to work with my best friends, and never once has it ever felt like work.
And how did you cast your mother and father, and have they ha had any comment about the actors and actresses that have been cast as them?
My parents are over the moon to get to see a caricature of them every day of it. My mom watches TBS solely to wait for commercials with me in it. That's how crazy it is for my folks' house. But Jodie Long is somebody that came in, and she plays my mother. She just nailed it. Like, as soon as she walked in, it's like, that's her. I mean, how can we not go with her? She's Okja. And then Dan Loria, actually been in New York City before we were casting, and he saw Dan Loria in Lombardi on Broadway, and he said, I think you guys might want to bring him in. I think he could be a good fit. And the minute we met Dan, we just all looked at each other. As soon as Dan left the room, we're like, we got to get him. I mean, if he's willing to do this, we got to get him. And so that's how we got Dan Lurie and Jodie Long.
And how's the reaction been so far to Hank's character? I've seen he's been described in some reviews as the sort of pub's token racist.
Yeah, that's fair to say. But I think, again, as the season goes on, he says racial things, but he's not a racist. If people, again, people hear those trigger words and they hear coloreds, they hear Mexicans, they think, oh, he's hateful. But if you really listen to the speech, he's a guy that is accepting of each new wave of whatever ethnic background is new to that neighborhood. And in the speech, he acknowledges that. And that's why he talks about why he loves hanging out at the bar. If he was truly racist, he wouldn't hang out at the bar. So I don't think there's ever any racist things that are said. It's just racial things that are said, and they always come from a good a place, a well-spirited place. And I think there's an episode where we actually acknowledge Hank's character and why he talks that way. And it's one of my favorite episodes of the season, and I hope people watch it and accept it and accept it in the way that it was intended to be. And that's humorous and thoughtful and coming from a well-spirited place.
Just to round up, where can people find out more about the show or tune in?
Well, the show is on Thursday nights at TBS. It's 10 o'clock, 9 Central. If you need to get caught up with the show, you can download the episodes at iTunes or just go to TBS.com and get all the biographies on the characters and see full episodes at TBS.com as well. You just find the show Sullivan and Son under shows.
Great. Well, listen, Steve, thank you very much for joining us here today in
Yeah.
Korean Context. And yeah, wish you all the best of the show.
Hey, thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me.
I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.